call the House State Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, March 11th, 1991. The time is 8:39. We have Representatives Cabino, Moyer. We have Representatives Cabino, Moyer, Baker, and Miller. Let me get everybody's name down.
So many of us here this morning.
So we noted, duly noted that without the minority, we would not have a quorum here this morning. Today we'll be taking up House Bill 47 relating to PERS benefits for youth center employees, HDR 22 relating to opposing reduction in federal COLA, Senate Bill 24 relating to appropriation and longevity bonus program, Senate Bill 32 relating to PERS benefits for youth center employees, SJR 15 relating to opposing federal COLA reductions, and House Bill 67 relating to the impoundment of mistreated animals. I'd like to take up first, if we could, SJR 15. Senator Duncan, would you join us, sir? We will use the microphones, although people are disarmed for listening. SJR 15 by Senator Duncan and HJR 22 by Representative Hudson. Both these resolutions express opposition to a proposed reduction in the cost of living allowance currently granted federal employees living in Alaska. There is a draft committee substitute. The CS incorporates language from both Senator Duncan's and Representative Hudson's. We put Representative Hudson's also on the calendar because they were similar bills, but my understanding of protocol, once the Senate measure gets here, we'll use that as the vehicle. But Senator Duncan, thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief in testimony on SJR 15. I appreciate your scheduling. Yet, as you stated, I assume you do have a committee substitute that's been prepared just to bring together my resolution and also Representative Hudson's resolution, the language of both, and I have no problem with the committee substitute the way it's put together. I think both Representative Hudson and I sponsored the resolution in reaction to the recent Federal Office of Personnel Management study indicating that COLA may be reduced in the state of Alaska or severely cut. In some parts, my understanding was the study would recommend a zero COLA for the Anchorage area and reduction to 5% for this area. We had some concerns about the way that initial study was done and the impact it would have on the federal employees in the state of Alaska. The resolution asked the personnel office to go back to review that study, to redo it, and take a look at some other factors as they're doing the new study and hopefully come out with a more acceptable recommendation. That's basically it. I'm not sure I need to get into any real details on it other than to urge your action on the resolution so that we can hopefully have some impact on the decision.
My understanding is this is, since they came out with that initial report on this, that everybody got pretty scared. They sort of said it's not going to happen overnight, but they're certainly looking into still reducing that COLA, huh?
As far as I know, they are, and the resolution is trying to encourage them to take to look at some specific areas as they go back and review their study, because there are, of course, without doubt, areas where the cost of living is much higher in Alaska than elsewhere. I think on page 2 of the resolution, for example, lines 19 through 23, it talks about the higher cost of living, medical care and services, transportation, etc., and also requesting to come and do personal interviews with federal employees as they're trying to do it from long distance. So we're asking them to look specifically at some areas which undoubtedly there are a greater cost in the state of Alaska than elsewhere.
Questions from the committee? Representative Moyer.
No, thank you,
Your Honor.
Thanks for the reminder. Senator Duncan, do you know if the federal government looks at locally available data? For example, in the North Star borough, they use, they produce pretty comprehensive quarterly statistics on the cost of living in Fairbanks, sometimes even compared to Anchorage.
I cannot answer that question. However, that's our hope, is that when they would look at locally available data, and also, as we say, interview local people to get a real feel. So, but I don't know the answer to your question, Mr. Winner.
I'd be glad to provide it if you're interested.
Representative Shoket?
I'd like to move this bill out.
You're,
I'd like to make a motion we move this bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
First of all, first thing we'll have to do is adopt the committee substitute. I'll take a motion on that.
So moved.
There is a motion to adopt the committee substitute. Is there objection to the motion?
No.
No objection. Discussion on the committee substitute. Representative Bruckman.
Would you read the title specifically? We have three here, and I think I know which one.
Right, we're talking about CES. It says House CES for Senate Joint Resolution 15, and now there's a parenthesis with nothing. That would be State Affairs opposing the proposed reduction in cost of living allowance for our employees. It's the 227.91.
Okay. Straightforward.
Any discussion on that? For the record, Representative Choquette joined us. Is there any discussion on the committee substitute? Not, I'll entertain a motion. Representative Choquette.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass the bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
Hearing no objections, there is a motion to pass committee substitute for SJR 15 State Affairs out of committee with individual recommendations. That was easy one, Senator. This time I'd like to take up committee substitute for Senate Bill 32 by Senator Duncan and House Bill 47 by Representative Ulmer, which both deal with granting PERS retirement benefits to employees of the juvenile corrections institutions. The only difference between these two bills is Senate Bill 32 also extends PERS benefits to nurses who work in the youth center. Senator Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me give a brief overview of Senate Bill 32, and then I'm sure that you have folks on the teleconference or others who want to testify on it. I do appreciate you scheduling the bill at this time. Senate Bill 32 provides juvenile correctional officers and also now the nurses in the juvenile correctional system a 20-year retirement by granting them peace officer status in the public employees retirement system. This status in the retirement system is 20-year now. It is currently afforded to peace officers, firefighters, probation officers, and adult correctional officers. In fact, last year, you may recall, we passed legislation adding probation officers to the 20-year now system. Employees at state juvenile correctional facilities have many of the same responsibilities as personnel in adult correctional institutions. Because of the hazardous nature of the work, I feel it is appropriate to include these employees in the 20-year retirement system. As I said, the committee substitute also adds in nurses in juvenile correctional facilities, allowing them to participate in the 20-year now system. I think in your package you have a copy of a letter from a nurse who would fit into this category, Karen Becker Brown, who's supporting inclusion of such nurses in the legislation and outlines a little bit some of their duties. Among the other hazardous duties which they perform in the institutions, they are also on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every other week. Also in the packet of information which I have provided is a position paper from the Alaska Juvenile Correctional Officer Association. Among their many important points noted in the paper is that peace officers are encouraged to retire before the inevitable loss of physical and emotional stamina, which occurs with age. Due to the potential for physical interaction with agitated and powerful juveniles, I believe this is an important consideration which has been overlooked in the case of youth correctional employees. These employees are often required to physically restrain out-of-control juveniles and apprehend those who have escaped from the institutions. A review of the statistics supplied by the Alaska Juvenile Correctional Officers Association reveals that the number of admissions for felonies is increasing along with the number of assaults on juvenile correctional officers. The number of injuries to juvenile correctional officers has increased dramatically over the past few years. Retirement system parity between the youth and adult correctional systems would allow for transfers between the two systems, as well as promotional opportunities which do not currently exist between the two systems. As I said, I think there's probably folks online or others who work in the system who can give you some better experiences that, of course, I can relate. That really is a brief overview of the bill. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your scheduling.
Thank you, Senator. Questions from the committee? Representative Choquette.
Senator Duncan, I have a proposed amendment to this bill. Make available to the committee. I basically included your amendments with an addition of we're supervisor of a juvenile probation program right on the top, Jim. And as I overlook the amendment that you've given us on the Senate bill, I include a youth counselor, unit leader, or superintendent of a juvenile correctional institution. The supervisor of the juvenile probation program is a constituent of mine, and I'm sure you just fell in the cracks. This is kind of being included in this, and I would ask that you consider this to be a friendly amendment.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chairman, I usually consider amendments friendly to departments that don't. However, I don't know what the impact of that is. I don't know if that's one individual or more, or I don't even know what the duties are, so I would rely upon, I don't have any problems. I just rely upon, probably going to change this one. No, one person probably should not. But let me add, by the way, Mr. Chairman, that in Mr. Choquette's amendment, the one thing he does leave out is or nurse, which we have to substitute.
No problem.
So I was hoping he wasn't putting in the supervisor dropping the nurse. That might not go too well. But
Mr. Chairman, the nurse is overlooked on my part and happily included in my amendment.
So as I understand your amendment, Representative Choquette, you would just add supervisor of a juvenile probation program.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about one person here, Representative
mm-hmm.
Choquette?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman, one person. I've also added the words youth counselor, which Representative or Senator Duncan did, unit leader, as he did, superintendent, as he has, and I'm adding nurse.
So your only amendment is adding supervisor of a juvenile probation program. That is your amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I understand that, a superintendent of a juvenile correctional institution is also, the wording is superintendent or nurse in a juvenile correctional institution. Is that correct, Senator?
That's correct.
Then that is my only amendment.
Senator, the only question I have is, we did add some more people to the 20-year. Just let me ask philosophically, you know, how many people do we continue adding to the 20-year, and at what point? I believe I read in the fiscal notes that it wouldn't have a real adverse impact on the PERS system. But are we headed towards, shall we make everybody 20-year, or is there a real
Well, I think that's a policy call on the part of the legislature if we want to make a 20-year now system for everyone. That's not what I'm proposing. I'm proposing that people in like occupations with like hazardous type duties, et cetera, such as peace officers, the firemen, the adult correctional officers, juvenile probation officers, who do have a different line of work than many other public employees do and has more hazard attached to it, that they be in a 20-year now system because of the stress and level of stress they go through on their daily job. To answer your question, as I said at the beginning, if we want to make all folks 20 years out, that's a policy decision, but I'm not recommending it at this time.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not directed to the senator, but it's directed as a fiscal note. Whoever prepared this fiscal note really messed up royally.
Are you talking about the one we just got?
Well, it's the one that's the one that was in the packet.
The one in the packet?
Yeah, it's a two-page fiscal note. I'm not sure if they're messing if they used the wrong numbers here, but the numbers, if you multiply this out, the cost would be not $168,000, but $16 million, because 1% of $561 million is a little over $5 million. So I don't know who prepared this fiscal note, but they messed up royally.
Which fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'm not going to take credit for this fiscal note.
That's what we thought it may have been, but whoever prepared this fiscal note needs to take note that I'm no mathematical genius, but even I picked up on that one.
It's only up top $165 million, but who's counting?
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Senator Duncan. We will take some testimony. You're more than welcome to stay with us. Thank you, sir. You should have it on your desk.
I have one of the state of Maryland.
February 23rd.
Sure.
He never comes.
Oh, geez.
That's all right. Don't worry.
Greg Roth, please. Mr. Roth, would you state your name and position to the record?
My name is Greg Roth. I'm a member of the Alaska Juvenile Correctional Officers Association. I'm here today just to voice my support on behalf of the members for Senate Bill 32 and House Bill 47. I think Senator Duncan did an excellent job of just describing what it is we actually do. And I don't want to repeat and go over what Senator Duncan has presented to you today. I would like to point out just a little briefly a couple of items that concern the reality of the youth corrections positions that that our folks work in. That we do arrest juveniles, we detain them, we apprehend them. Occasionally we have to restrain them. Sometimes we are assaulted by juveniles. Sometimes the juveniles are larger than the staff. And all of this is in the performance of our duty. I believe that the 20-year retirement bill is logical and fair and just, and that the population that Youth Corrections serves has gone beyond. There was some mention of how many people were going to be included in this, and also juvenile probation was placed under the system last year. The kids that we're dealing with are kids that have gone beyond the kids that the juvenile probation officers are dealing with. These are kids that are completely out of control, and it's our job to get them back under control within the confines of the institution. I'd also like to, I hope it's in your packet, referring to Alaska Statute 4710210 that provides or mandates the powers of the peace officer with respect to the service and process of making arrests of minors who violate state or municipal law and execution of orders of court relating to juveniles. Basically, how I see this is that by statute we are given this responsibility, we are authorized to carry out these duties, and have not been recognized in respect to the retirement system for these responsibilities. Thank you for your consideration of testimony.
You're welcome, Greg. Does the committee have any questions, Mr. Roth? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I have online in Anchorage Bob Fedoroff. Fedoroff, are you available?
Yes, sir, I am.
Would you state your name and address, please, and your position for the record?
My name is Bob Fedoroff. My address is 1814 Steeple Drive, Steeple River, Alaska. And I'm a unit leader at McLaughlin Youth Center. I'm speaking on behalf of the Alaska Juvenile Correctional Officers Association. The job class is addressed in these bills. And rather than repeat what Mr. Ross said and what Mr. Duncan said, I'll only reiterate that failure to include youth counselors, youth unit leaders, and youth facility superintendents employed at juvenile correctional institutions in the 20-year retirement system has resulted in an inequity between similar job classifications in the adult and juvenile justice system. The job characteristics of law enforcement powers, danger, stress, and the need for physical and emotional fitness, which justified inclusion of correctional officers and correctional superintendents, are present to an equal and often greater degree with youth counselors, unit leaders, and youth facility superintendents. Youth counselors are required to physically restrain out-of-control juveniles, transport juvenile offenders to court appearances, and apprehend juveniles who have been absconded from institutional custody. Our work environment is a setting where the most serious and dangerous youthful offenders are confined by the court. Throughout their duty day, youth counselors, unit leaders, and youth facility superintendents work directly with and are in close proximity with confined youthful offenders. Youth personnel, the aggressive and assaultive towards youth facility staff who are charged with supervising and controlling their behavior. The disparate treatment of youth counselors, unit leaders, and youth facility superintendents with respect to 20-year retirement demoralizes the ineligible employees and reduces the benefits to the employing agency of an established progressive career track. There is less incentive for youth counselors, unit leaders, or youth facility superintendents to seek professional advancement in the youth correction system rather than in the adult correction system. And that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Bob. Is there any questions from the committee? All right. Thank you, sir. This is the same as the one that's in here. It's the old one, but it's different numbers, but it's from the same department. We're looking over the fiscal notes and trying to understand. We actually have two fiscal notes, one that we received this morning, one that was already in your packet. One already in your packet was from Health and Social Services. The one that we got this morning is from the administration. And there's also one that was hooked on to House Bill 47 that is in that is similar to the one in our packet from Health and Social Services with a slightly different number. Tom Bergstrom, please. Tom, you're working with Health and Social Services this year? Would you state your name and position for the record, please?
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Bergstrom. I'm a special assistant at the Department of Health and Social Services. The difference between the two fiscal notes, HB 47 and SB 32, reflects the three nurses that are included under SB 32 and not under the original HB 47. If Representative Choquette's amendment were adopted, the fiscal note for HB 47 would be the same as that for SB 32.
Well, if we're looking at the fiscal note for SB 32, which is 100.2 thousand,
yes,
that would go up slightly with Representative Choquette's.
A negligible amount. It would be
one person.
1.13%.
Is that what we're talking about on his amendment? Only one person?
I believe so. It would be in the neighborhood of $500 or $600. It would be a negligible amount of money.
Representative Bloomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that describes the difference between the fiscal note that was signed by Russ Webb on 2/25 and the one that was signed by Michael Price on March 8th. But the difference, then let's contrast the March, we'll call it the Webb. I'm sorry.
So that we keep them, we understand the difference in the 47 and the 32. Let's forget that.
I'm not sure
47.
We do. Because if we take a look, I see. Yes. Okay. Yes. Right.
So we're dealing with only two, the two that we have for Senate Bill 32.
Right. And have you had a chance to review the fiscal note submitted March 7 by Retirement and Benefits?
I have.
Okay. Well, that calculates it differently than you did, and it comes out to a 168.6, and they proceed from a different premise. You have calculated yours average base salary times percent increase. They have calculated theirs state FY93 payroll times percentage increase. And it would strike me that if your figures are accurate, you know exactly how many people are involved, that's probably more accurate than a percentage of state payroll.
I would have to let the Department of Administration refer to that. Ours is 165 employees without the nurses, 168 with the nurses. It would be 169 with Representative Choquette's addition. My understanding is, and I have to let administration address it, I believe the two fiscal notes are cumulative, but...
You have calculated, if I may, Mr. Chairman, looking at the fiscal note, first page of your fiscal note, 168 employees, first paragraph under analysis. Looking at theirs, page 2 of 2, they, final line of first paragraph under analysis, have calculated 170 members. I don't know, maybe it's something that finance should look at, but just something that you guys should check out.
Representative Greenberg, if I might ask you something here. Mm-hmm. How does this exactly work now with fiscal notes? We have not adopted any fiscal notes with bills. Normally, that's when it goes to finance, they will do that. Is it appropriate at times to inform them or tell them that we think one fiscal note is better than another, or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we can do anything we want, and I certainly encourage committees of first referral like us to, if we see something in a fiscal note, to do whatever we feel is appropriate. I would say, in this particular case, we ought to send a note from the chairman of this committee to the chairman of finance, pointing out the difference between the two and asking the finance committee to check into this further. And also pointing out that because of the Choquette Amendment, there'll be one additional person we feel in this. And maybe even sending copies to the two departments so that they would know and be able to confer on the staff.
The department in their fiscal note and their backup does not say whether they support or do not support this bill. Do they have a position on it?
Speaking of one approaching 20 years, as a personal matter, I certainly favor the bill.
But does the department have a position on it?
No, we don't. We believe that this sort of bill needs to be judged in the context of all state employees, and that the proper place for that is employee relations and Department of Administration rather than individual affected agents.
And do you have any idea if they have a position on the bill?
I believe they are opposed to it, but I want them to be proved out on that.
I would like that. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Greenberg.
Do we have anybody from them here?
We're going to get to them next. Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess that brings up, a baseline issue. Is this a collective bargaining issue versus
is your mic on, Representative Baker?
Excuse me.
I'm
wondering if this is something that is more appropriately in collective bargaining rather than trying to legislate. Mr. Baden probably answered that by saying that I guess it could be handled either way. It can either be handled through statute or through collective bargaining, but this may well be an issue that should be in that arena rather than here.
Any other comments from the committee? Representative Greenberg?
That's an issue. Thank you. I'm sure. That phrasing it that way is something I have not heard in all the time I've been down here, but I think you've hit on a key issue, Representative Baker. And I guess there are two ways of looking at something like this. Number one, do you wish it to be the subject of collective bargaining in this particular case, or are there other policy reasons that the legislature should become involved? Because normally this would be collective bargaining, but here these folks are saying that because we are in a dangerous situation, because we are essentially putting ourselves on the line, we should be entitled as a policy matter, not as a matter of collective bargaining, but as a policy matter. We're a small group and not very powerful, but we should be entitled as a policy matter to these additional benefits. But I think that you phrased the issue in one very interesting way that could certainly be argued one way or the other.
Other comments from the committee before I hear from the administration? Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Someone from the administration that I could hear this morning?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Bader. I'm from the Department of Administration, Division of Retirement Benefits.
Just to address a few of the issues raised before the committee as to collective bargaining or legislation. While I don't pretend to be the last word on this, I believe it is appropriate for the committee to take up this legislation. I don't believe that we could change a person's membership and retirement system through the collective bargaining process, since their rights to retirement are defined in statute. Unless we were to find that that classification met the legislative description of who should be covered under peace officers' retirement system. Secondly, on the issue of fiscal notes between the two departments, there are really two things that happen in a bill such as this. The person who is in the classification that is being moved from one retirement system to another has an accumulated amount of state service that must be funded actuarially. Mr. Bergstrom testified that the addition of one person to this bill would cost about $500 a year. And I think that's probably pretty close. I don't know what their salary is, but the rate, that's pretty close. $500 a year from now on. And if a new incumbent were to come into that position, the incremental cost would also be approximately $500. However, at the same time in this bill, there is a accumulation of state service that must be funded. And that is the difference between the two department fiscal notes. The accumulated state service, people who have served for 10, 15 years or whatever length of time already, must be funded in a different way than what Department of Health and Social Services would do. That is what you see in the Department of Administration fiscal note. It does not require a direct appropriation to the Department of Administration. That's why you see it in the narrative down at the bottom of the note. We estimate that the increased cost to fund that is approximately 0.0001%, 0.0003 times the state payroll. That will be a general increase in the PERS rate. That is our estimate. Department of Health and Social Services would have approximately 170 employees that would be members of the Peace Officer Retirement System. Therefore, that increment, the difference between the regular PERS rate, if you will, and the peace officer rate is about 1.2% of their salaries, and that's what you see reflected in that fiscal note. So I hope that brings some clarity to the difference between the fiscal notes and what they represent.
Representative Grunberg.
Then am I correct that we need to send both of these fiscal notes on because they're both additional costs? It's not either or, but it's both.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
So you're saying the total cost was really $268,000 a year?
I have not had an opportunity to see HNSS's fiscal notes, but if that's what they add up to, that's correct.
It's 100.2. Maybe you can go take a look at it.
Lieutenant Baker, perhaps yes. You could show him that fiscal note.
It's 100.2
onto our 168 would be. However, I should add that this is not the Department of Administration's fiscal note is informational. There would not be the appropriation would not be required this year. That's one thing that I think has caused a lot of confusion over the years. As you look at your fiscal note, there's nothing in personal services. In other words, we wouldn't be asking the legislature to give us $168,000. What we're saying is that down the road, the level of contributions would be increased. The rate for this year's budget is already set, so there's going we would not anticipate increasing this year's PERS rate at all. There would be no additional collections. What our note represents is that down the road, this back service is going to have to be funded in order to maintain the same level of funding.
Sam Grunberg.
This is the first time I've known anything about this. How far down the road and how much is it going to cost and how's it going to be handled? This is the first time we've really, as a committee, gotten into anything quite like this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, each year when the budget is prepared
Office of Management and Budget is given a retirement system rate to assist each agency in computing their personal services costs. What we're seeing in our fiscal note is that that rate is likely to go up 0.03% in future years to fund this back service. Over time, as the back service is funded, the rate would dissipate.
Do you have any idea when this would start going up?
In the FY93 budget.
So would we be then looking at an increased appropriation in the FY93 budget?
For the Department of Health and Social Services, I believe so.
Then shouldn't that be reflected somewhere in the fiscal note, one fiscal note or the other for FY93 and following?
I'll have to check the effective date again, but I believe it should be.
It's an SS actually.
HNSS's note, in my judgment, would be correct. It would show in the FY92 budget.
I just don't see your figure showing up in either budget under FY93. I don't see anything on the first page of yours, and I see nothing on the first page of theirs reflecting yours.
Perhaps that would be... we could show it in FY93. However, I would say, Mr. Chairman, that over the years when the Department of Administration has put things in those boxes under personal services, sometimes the message is misconstrued, and sometimes the legislature might actually be adding to our budget, and that's not what we're suggesting. We're simply providing information that over time there's going to be an increased cost to the system. If we did put it there, it would be incorrect because actually our costs are going to be absorbed by all agencies. They're a cost to the system, not an increase to the Department of Administration. They're a cost to the retirement system.
Mr. Vader, could you tell me the department's position on this bill? Not the fiscal position, but their position on support or non-support?
Mr. Chairman, generally the department's position is that unless we find that the purpose of the bill is to, if we find that there's a recruitment problem, generally we are in favor of the bill. We don't know that that is the case here, and therefore we're in opposition to the bill.
Why wouldn't that be something that we would have here in writing when we take up the bill? Is that something that you know, I'm new at this. Is that something normally not done, or it's just done verbally, or just normally do you take actual position in writing to the committee so that people understand the reasoning behind it?
I think based on other conversations I've had today that it certainly would add a lot of clarity if we could make sure that the position papers are available to sponsors and committees in advance of committee hearings. In some cases it is done, I think, with other departments, and to my knowledge, Department of Administration's position papers are not available, have not been made available, but I think that can, I'll discuss that with the commissioner.
Can you tell me if the department has vocalized their opposition in the Senate hearings?
My understanding is that that they have not.
So we've taken this bill all the way through with one full house of the legislature without people really understanding and knowing that that the administration is opposed to the bill, and we get it to our committee, the next to last committee in the entire process, virtually on a way of taking it to the floor and not understanding. Thank you. Representative Bruckman.
I didn't have my hand
raised. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you, I could see the lights going on in your face, and I thought you wanted to say something.
Well, I voted for Zyde and the comments that were just made.
Comments from the committee. Representative Bloomberg.
With just one more pass over what we were talking about before, because I'm not entirely clear. It looked to me like the Department of Health and Social Services fiscal note reflected the increase in the salary resulting from this bill. Is that correct?
Personal service costs, yes.
Okay. And that personal service cost would go up starting this year. That's why they've done this.
This coming budget year, yes.
But there were also going to be other costs to the rest of the system, and that is reflected in your fiscal note.
That's correct.
And that wouldn't occur until the following year.
That's correct.
Then maybe I'm just ignorant or confused or both. But it seems to me that that should be reflected in FY 93 and following on the base of your fiscal note.
And if I might interject here, it seems like what he's saying is it would be misleading to put it on an administration fiscal note, because it really would not be an appropriation to the Department of Administration. It would be something that the overall PERS system would have to. So well, I think what you're saying is this is the cost, but this isn't where it really should be reflected. Mm-hmm. Maybe there should be a fiscal note from the PERS system themselves that says in the long over the years this is what it's going to cost us. Is that what you're saying?
That might be another approach. There have been a number of approaches tried over the year. I do recall that a few years ago that the number was reflected up on the top of the legislature. It was actually a negative number, I believe, and the legislature actually appropriated the cut. And, of course, it was never in Department of Administration's budget to begin with. And so I had to work out of that.
Representative Greenberg.
Yeah, I guess what we're sort of floundering maybe saying is that the Department of Administration should look at a different kind of something to, so even us legislators can understand these fiscal notes. And I see now, if you understand the way these work, how this does, but it's not clear to the general public, and it's not clear to us. And also, it certainly wasn't clear to us what your position on this bill was, that you oppose it. I think that should be stated frankly. Are you going to be recommending a veto?
I haven't even thought of that. I've given you the Department of Administration's position on the bill. I have not purported that that is the administration's position. I simply am not privy to that information. Whether or not the, because we've also heard from the Department of Health and Social Services that they have no particular difficulty with the bill.
You traditionally on these things, you usually oppose the administration.
Usually, yes.
Yeah, this is fairly standard.
That's correct.
And we pass it.
Any other questions, Mr. Bader? Thank you, sir. I'd only maybe want to, well, that's probably not the best person to say it to. I wish someone was here from PERS. There is no one here from PERS, I take it. First of all, I'd like to entertain an amendment to the bill. Representative Choquette.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that this committee take on the amendment that I passed out to you, which has been amended to also read on line 8, after the word probation officer, comma, supervisor of a juvenile probation program, comma, or youth counselor, comma, unit leader.
I think that's all the amendment really is. Supervisor of a juvenile probation program.
Okay, we've already adopted the amendment from Senator Duncan.
No, that's not an amendment. That is the bill, the way it's written there. Your amendment would just add supervisor of a juvenile probation program.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're not working on 47.
No, we're
working
not.
On 32.
That's correct.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
There is an amendment. Is there objection to the amendment? Representative Greenberg.
No, I support the amendment, Mr. Chairman, but just a technical question, because I don't want this bill to have a problem. Looking at the title of the bill, certain juvenile correction institution employees, I'm not sure that a probation officer is a correction institution employee. And I think I support the amendment. I co-sponsored the bill in the House, and I support the bill. But I would ask us to check with legal counsel. It may require a concurrent resolution to change the title. And if so, this committee should introduce such a resolution and pass it back to the Senate.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't think so. It says, and persons who supervise juvenile probation programs.
I'm not sure that they are, Mr. Chairman, employees of the correction institution itself. I don't know. They may be. They may not be. 47.
32, fire chief, comma, probation officer, comma, or youth counselor.
Right.
432.
Now, we have different titles on 47 and 32.
Mr. Chairman.
I was looking at the wrong one also.
What we have?
Let me read an act granting certain juvenile correction institution employee status as police under public employees retirement system. Representative Greenberg.
Yeah, if the members would look at the blank CS for House Bill 47 and contrast it to the Senate State Affairs CS for Senate Bill 32, looking at the title, you'll see that in the blank CS, they have added, quote, "and persons who supervise juvenile probation programs," unquote, in addition to the juvenile correction institution employees, indicating that at least Terry Kramer thought they didn't fall under that. I think we're going to have to maybe have to change the title. If so, that's not hard to do. We simply do it and we pass back with this a concurrent resolution, which I imagine would have no problem in this particular case. And I think that the State Affairs Committee ought to do that. So we're correct and legal in this thing.
Can anyone from the administration tell me if the people that are in this now, the youth counselor, unit leader, superintendent, or nurse in a juvenile correction institution, those people all work for corrections? Tom, can you or Gary?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I don't specifically know the answer to that question. I believe that they are in separate components within the corrections. I can check that, I believe, in a matter of minutes.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
But the... thank you, Tom. Somebody else has some ideas here? Greg, right?
Yeah, this is Greg Roth again. This particular position supervises, the working title is Youth Corrections Administrator. This position supervises all the youth corrections probation and all the youth corrections facilities.
Both.
Right. So you're talking about his amendment where he calls it Supervisor of Juvenile Probation Program. Its real title is?
Youth Corrections Administrator.
And does he work for corrections?
He works, yes. Not for adult corrections. He works in the juvenile correctional system and supervises the institutions.
I don't know. I think we need to check it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Is the term, quote, supervisor of a juvenile probation program, unquote, I'm asking.
Sir, my bad, sir.
Is the correct term, quote, supervisor of a juvenile probation program, or should there be some other term used instead?
Well, common sense, I would think that the working title of Youth Corrections Administrator would make more sense, but if the working title changed at some point, then I'm not sure, but it's been that way for quite some time now. So does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman.
We think so. Representative Shilkat.
Mr. Chairman, in both Senate Bill 32 and in the proposed amendment that I offered today, we are identifying a superintendent in a juvenile correctional institution. All that my bill does is also ask for the supervisor of a juvenile probation system. So whatever the title is or what it can be do, this is his duties. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And this would take care of the amendment.
Well, the problem we have is if that amendment fits in under the title, and we cannot change the title of the Senate bill.
Unless
we do another resolution asking for it.
All right, Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunberg, if you'll notice that in the section, the Senate bill as it has been submitted, we are discussing probation officers. I draw your attention to line 7.
No, we're not that, Mr. Chairman. That is not changed in the bill. That's in current law.
Okay.
The only thing this bill deals with is what's underlined.
Right. But it's very simple to do, Mr. Chairman. All we have to do is, what I'm suggesting is not a big deal in this particular case.
I think what my intention is to hold this bill till Wednesday to discuss with legal the ability of including this amendment under the existing title so that we know exactly what we're doing and what we have the ability to do. Rep. Sam Breckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that person a police officer at all? That administrator that we're discussing? That one person, the administrator, is that person a police officer? Were they trained under, like other correctional institutional employees, sworn officers in the room?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe he is. I know that they've had all kinds of training.
Right. This generally the person.
Mr. Roth.
Thank you. Generally, the the person that fills the position is someone that, that has come up through the ranks of the youth corrections peace officer type duties. And this is the end of the classified service type positions. The next position would be a, an exempt or partially exempt position or an appointed type position. Does that answer your question?
No, that's okay. No, but you try. I thought the person might fit under the language of that person had been a sworn officer like a number of the other employees. What would automatically fall under?
We'll talk to legal and see how we should progress. Is there any objections to that? This bill is in a subcommittee, myself, whoever else wants to be on it. But
well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shilkat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gruenberg, obviously I don't see the problem. I think we need somebody with a legal mind and understanding titles to be on this committee. I don't think we have a conflict here. I think we just have a question of how to do it. I would suggest that I'm not the best person to know how to do it. And Representative Gruenberg should bring us in the correct way to do it.
Representative Shilkat is in a subcommittee, myself and anybody else on the committee that wants to be in it. We'll have it back to us as quick as we can. Any other questions on that, Bill?
No, if you could bring back the note we're going to send to the finance at the same time and try to support.
Good idea.
I don't think we need a vote. I think it's fine.
Well, I still think it needs to be discussed because I think that's a whole different ballgame. I mean, you're tripling your fiscal notice. That's true. All right, the next bill I'd like to bring up is Senate Bill 24 by Senator Petula. Senate Bill 24 will reinstate the governor's vetoes to the longevity bonus program and the program's hold harmless provisions. This time I'd like to invite Kathy Hathaway, Representative Senator Petula, to join the committee and brief us on Senate Bill 24. Hathaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kathy Hathaway. I work for Senator Petula. Senator Petula sent his apologies. He was unable to come in person. The chairman stated this correctly. It's the original Senate Bill 24 reinstated the $5 million veto to the longevity bonus program itself, plus Governor Cooper's $392,900 veto to the whole harmless appropriation. The bill was changed in the Senate Finance Committee to increase the whole harmless appropriation to $792,600. The Department of Health and Social Services testified before the Senate Finance Committee that that increase was necessary because of increased caseloads. If this supplemental is not passed, there will be no longevity bonus checks for the month of June. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. And stick with us a minute. Is there anybody signed up to testify? I take it not. Obviously, the bill is rather straightforward, and my understanding is the governor does support this, although there may be another vehicle for it. My suggestion, my intention was to move this bill along to finance and allow finance to determine what vehicle is going to be used. I would state that this bill has been okay for cross-sponsorship if any of you on the committee want to add your name to this bill. Any comments from the committee?
Seeking a motion?
I will. I would like a motion.
Are we still on the box?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I move that you CS for Senate Bill 24 finance from the committee and his recommendations ask unanimous consent.
Is there any objection? Then CS is moved with unanimous consent.
Is that automatically
on
all
our names? No, you still need to sign it.
No.
CS-24 has been moved from committee. Is anyone here from Representative Copeland's office? I would like to take up House Bill 67 at this time. Who's still online?
Yes, ma'am.
This way. Thank you. this one.
Public safety put in a new fiscal year for this.
We have prepared a committee substitute for House Bill 67 for discussion purposes. We have developed a committee substitute for House Bill 67. I believe the appropriate thing for discussion purpose would be to take it before us.
So moved.
Representative Greenberg has moved to a committee substitute for House Bill 67, State Affairs, for discussion purposes. Is there any objection? The bill is before us. I have a number of people in online to testify on this bill. I was not aware that we had so many people to testify again. Could you state your name and position for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Clark. I'm made to Representative Kopanen, who is unable to be with us this morning.
And as Representative Kopanen reviewed the committee substitute and believed that it gets at what he was trying to accomplish?
I believe he has, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have simplified this bill. We've moved really the provisions under criminal law, as I understand it. Actually, we've done both that amendments.
I'm sorry.
The second part now, Section 11, Section 2 of our bill?
Yeah.
Is under criminal law, which is in addition to the what was it called in the law?
Animals?
A cruelty to animals. This adds a section that would now be mistreatment to animals.
Mr. Chair, could I get a criminal substitute?
Oh. You should have one. And the impoundment part then is still under a different section that we were dealing with before. Representative Greenberg?
It was in the back when I reviewed the committee substitute. It was at the back of my mind. We already have a statute that deals with something along the same lines of this, just for the members to be aware. It's in the Lien statute in Title 34, and let me read just for general information. The following persons shall have liens upon personal property for their just and reasonable charges for the labor, care, and attention bestowed and the food furnished, and may retain possession of the property until the charges are paid. 3. A person who pastures or feeds horses, cattle, hogs, sheep, or other livestock, or bestows labor, care, or attention upon the livestock at the request of the owner or lawful possession of the livestock. And I think that would be read by a court to include any animals, frankly. And that came from territorial law. That's been on the books for years and years. Not well known. Except for those of us who read the statutes for fun and profit.
Section 11.
I'm sorry. The name of that, Mr. Chairman, is AS 34.35.220. And maybe we could get the staff or somebody to take a copy of that for us. And I'm sorry, it also permits, let me continue, I guess I should, the second section under that. There can be a sale to enforce the lien. If the charges are not paid within 3 months after the care, attention, and labor is performed or the food is furnished, the person having the lien may proceed to sell at public auction the property or whether part of it sufficient to pay for the just and reasonable charges.
So is your point that part of this on page 2 is really already covered by law that we don't need on the reimbursement?
This will go to judiciary next, I think. And that's something the judiciary committee can look at. I didn't want to hold the bill up or anything. I'm simply saying that that tickled the back of my mind when I read this thing, and it is indeed in the statute. I'm not sure, maybe that's something the sponsor would want to take a look at with the staff of Judiciary Committee or something. I think it's probably more appropriate in the Judiciary Committee to deal with it. But it's up to you and anybody else.
Any comments from the committee? Well, my intention is to hear a few of these people on teleconference. Mr. Stearns, are you there in Anchorage?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
Mr. Stearns, would you like to comment on the bill as it's rewritten?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Stearns. I'm a captain with the State Troopers assigned to the Department of Public Safety Commissioner's Office. It has gone a very long way in allowing for a number of changes that issues prior committee hearings. I would like to, however, just bring a couple of issues up for the committee's concern. One is that as one reads 5110 in regards to the availability to impound for criminals and then or for the protection of the animal and then allowing for an expedited appeal process, I'm a little concerned, although the Department of Law probably has a better explanation than I'm a little bit concerned over the distinction between the criminal seizure and holding of evidence until such time as the matter is completed by the court, and which would preclude most probably an impound hearing, although I'm not sure legally it would hold the laws there to address it also. I also, in having listened to the testimony and had a number of discussions with the people who want to see this bill go through, it would seem that it might be something to consider if we are going to allow it to return to the owner once the claims or fees have been reimbursed and returned, that there may be a need for at least some assurance that the owner has taken appropriate steps to fix the original problems, perhaps have received instruction on how to care for the animal, or perhaps has agreed to pay the fees and allow for adoption, something that certifies that the animal is going back to the proper care. And I guess finally that I would, in reading it, that any peace officer has this right, I am only assuming that the appeal hearing process under certainly the civil side of for protection of the animal would most, assuming that it would most probably be done in the Department of Law, although it wasn't exactly clear to me. Other than that, I certainly think that the parameters and the flexibility allowed by the committee substitute bill will certainly allow a number of methods to deal with the animal short of criminal act, which by the statistics that I've been able to hear should go a long, long way in dealing with the problems that have been discussed. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Stearns. Any questions from the committee? In Valdez, Shanna Anderson, can you hear us? Valdez?
Valdez, Shanna Anderson?
Yes, this is Shanna Anderson.
Shanna, go ahead, please. Please make your remarks brief. We have session in about 10 minutes, so we only have a few. All right, thank you. We're in Wasilla. I believe there's three people. Would you please state your name and address? Excuse me, an address and make your comments.
I'm Michelle Moss. My address is Post Office Box 870010, Wasilla, Alaska. The code 99687. Many Alaskans know of horses and other animals that have died or suffered a great deal because of cruelty or ignorance. Passage of House Bill 67 is needed to provide the authority to stop such abuses. People hang on to their beliefs, whether those beliefs are based on logic or ignorance. The threat of possible impoundment of their animals may encourage certain people to be more open-minded when it comes to suggestions about proper care and feeding. I hope that you will work for the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Max.
Oh, thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments by any other members of the committee? If not, thank you very much. Will we have the next witness, please?
I am Minnie Fisher from Mat-Su, and I'm going to yield because I spoke before.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Fisher? If not, next witness, please.
No questions at this time, but you will be hearing from me.
Thank you, Ms. Fisher. May we have the next witness, please?
That would be all from Mat-Su. Thank you.
Is there anyone else online?
Fairbanks, go right ahead.
Thank you. My name is Deb Nestor, and I'd like to cover some points in this bill that I think is read. First, I would like to remind all of you to think with your head, not your heart. Standard, the first part of this bill, page 1, line 6, the word or should be removed. Because this makes the thing too loose. The words health and well-being can be moved in place with the word life. Well-being of the animal is the interpreted. When you have a police officer removing the animal, it's authorized by the state, where it goes, and the needs determined by a licensed vet. This protects people from harassment from animal rights groups because a licensed vet
get her to speak closer into a word.
Ma'am, we have received a number of handwritten proposed amendments to the proposed State Affairs Committee substitute. And are you basically going over those handwritten comments that are apparently by Dixie Jennings?
No, I'm not.
Because it seems that you are making some of the same comments, and since you're making specific line changes. If you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chairman, this particular witness, if we could do them one at a time so we're sure that we understand the reasons for her specific suggestions. I think you were just going a little too fast, at least for me, and I wonder if we could start again and really listen to what she's saying here.
Ms. Nestor, if you'd start all the way at the beginning, please be clear right into the microphone because you're breaking up and it was real hard for us to tell what you're talking about.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Am I supposed to give the reasons for the changes or just go ahead and state changes?
If you just give the changes and then very briefly your reasoning.
And maybe stop at each one so we can
answer. On line 6, the very end of the line, the word or should be removed. It doesn't read properly with that word in there. It sounds like somebody can just come along and say, I don't like that dog on a 3-foot chain, and its well-being, it should be impounded. Okay, on line 7, the word health and well-being of animals should be replaced by the word life because the interpretation is too loosely made.
Mm-hmm.
by the state, and where need is determined by a licensed vet. Otherwise, people can be harassed by animal rights groups. A veterinarian who falsely accuses a person can lose their license, and people have recourse. We do not really have recourse against harassment by animal rights groups. And there are an awful lot of people out there that are against the eating of meat that could use this bill to save, quote-unquote, animals from being used for slaughter. On the second, also, rather than just covering a crime to impound the animal, this bill should also cover impoundment of animals in an emergency. If someone is in a car wreck in the middle of nowhere and they have horses in a trailer or a dog in a car, for the safety of the animal, it should be impounded if the people are unable to, you know, say they had to go to the hospital and this animal's just left at the side of the road. Somebody's house burns down, there's no neighbors to care for the animal, and the people are in the hospital or something like this. So for emergency purposes where no crime is being committed, the welfare of the animal should be taken into account. On page two, okay, on line two, the owner of an animal impounded under this section of the owner's agent shall have, you've got an opportunity for a hearing. That should be removed. The owner should have a hearing, period, not an opportunity for it. Also, if the owner prevails, you have that he'll get his animal back and won't be liable for the cost and everything. He should also be able to be reimbursed for his expenses of fighting this if he's found not guilty. Then on line six there, you should address the question of liability. If an animal is impounded, is the state liable if, while impounded, that animal receives a disease or an injury or dies? If, while the animal is impounded, is the state liable? Should that animal attack a human being or another animal or spread a disease? That needs to be addressed. The owner is no longer responsible for that animal once it's out of his care. So I think the state will have to bear all the liability for anything that happens or anything the animal does while it's in the care as it's impounded. Under line C, where we're talking about the cost of impounding, there should be a fixed rate in which the cost does not exceed the value of the animal. Otherwise, the state can wind up with a whole big bunch of dollars on their hands. And the cost should be the lowest rate in the area where the impoundment place where the animal is taken should be by bid process. This way, this avoids somebody that might be out to make some bucks by saying, I'll take all the animals. Should be put out to bid. Section D, where you're saying that if the animal isn't reclaimed within 60 days, it shall be put out to adoption or disposed of. What if it's still tied up in court? Do you need to add something there so that if people still have this tied up in court for longer than 60 days, they don't come back and find their animal's been killed? Also, the word dispatch should be replaced by receipt. Because just because you mail the letter doesn't mean the person in charge of the animal got it. Also down here where it's to be put out for adoption, it should go to the highest bidder to avoid people possibly collecting animals under this law for other people. It should strictly be the highest bidder when it's put out for adoption. And then when you say the animal's to be disposed of in a humane manner, if the animal was going to die anyway, I'm confused here that the state says we'll go ahead and kill it, but we'll charge the owner because the animal would have died if it stayed with the owner, but it's okay for the state to kill it. Under item E, where the state veterinarian sets the regulations and guidelines, these should be addressed under several public hearings, and the guidelines must be in black and white so people know exactly what is and is not. Under F, where the definition of animal, I understand there's some people who want a bunch of animals taken out, or for this bill to apply only to horses. You cannot morally justify the exemption of any animal under this definition, as they all have a right to humane
also. Under the mistreatment of animals, section 1161142, you've got a person commits a crime of mistreatment except an emergency and so on. This should be determined by a certified vet, and it should also include animals that are in the process of being transported. Many animals are locked up into trucks or kennels and aren't fed or watered for over 24 hours, so transportation of animals should be included. In the very first hearing, Neil Kopanen made the statement when asked if an outfitter or guide was going to abandon their animals, what difference does it make if we threaten him with impoundment? And he stated, if I'm correct, stated that if the guide or outfitter did not have sufficient food on hand at the very start, he was in the intent of abandoning him. A whole lot of us do not have an entire year's supply of food on hand. I think it is wrong to assume that someone who doesn't have enough food for a year or who knows how long is intending to abandon their animal. That's guilt before the fact, and that needs to be addressed. Also, the words on line 22 of page 2, number 1, about abandonment. You should remove again the words and well-being. That's too loosely interpreted, and it should just read the continued life and health of the animal. Part 2, once again, the words well-being should be removed, and it should just read life and health of an animal. So, from the word including the failure to provide for, everything else down to line, including line C, should possibly be removed because this is all addressed in number 1 and the first part of number 2. If you don't remove it, then on line A under number 2, food of sufficient quantity and quality. What is sufficient quantity? A year's supply, a week's supply, a day's supply? Quality. It is my understanding at this time there is no truth in labeling law for livestock feeds sold within the state of Alaska. I, right now, on the bed of my pickup, have 400-pound bales of hay that was sold to me as number one hay. It is full of mold. If I had fed that to my animals, they could have died. There is no truth in labeling. A farmer, a livestock grain raiser can sell you anything and say it's right. And now with quality added into this, the animal's owner can be held responsible when under good faith he feels he's feeding his animal proper food. We need a truth in labeling law added to our agricultural laws. Access to potable water. In the wintertime, dog mushers mix water with their animal's feed. Horse owners, some of us are lucky enough to have electricity where we can keep water heaters so our animal has water all the time. Others of us give the animals water in the morning or the evening, but they are given water. What is access to potable water mean? And what kind of containers and how much? Under C, veterinarian care by a licensed vet. Which vet? The owner's vet or the state vet? If it's a state vet, is the vet controlled by how much money he can charge the accused owner? Is the vet liable if the wrong care, etc., is demanded or diagnosed to avoid the impoundment of the animal? Many vets can argue you can have two vets and sometimes get three answers on how the animal should be cared for. So there again, the owner must also be protected. And on the third page, once again, animal should be all animals. We cannot morally justify the fact that some animals have more rights to humane treatment than others. And that addresses most of my thing right now. Oh, one other thing. Under the cruelty law, it's stated here that in defense of prosecution, the incident was necessarily tied up with lawful hunting and trapping activities. I assume that trappers using dogs, hunters, outfitters, guides using llamas or equines to pack things in are not immune or exempt from inhumane treatment to their animals because they are using them for hunting and trapping. So I want to be sure that that is also addressed. Thank you.
What's your name?
Hello, my name is Dixie Jennings. There was just, I'm from 422 NRA Lane, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99709. I'd like like to add just a couple comments that I forgot to address in my statement that I sent to you. I'd like to say that I believe that it should go out to bid for hauling and stabling of the horses, so, or any of the animals, which whatever, for the impoundment of the animal. It should go out for bid if you're for people to haul or stable the horse animals. I also believe that this bill should stick to nutritional issues rather than getting into how the horses are, what kind of facilities they're kept in and this stuff, this area. I think it should be mainly sticking to the nutritional issues of the horses. And I also believe that impoundment should be the last resort. Also, one other statement, vets can do tests to determine a nutritional mistreatment. They can do blood tests and muscle tissue tests to determine their nutritional misuse. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Dixie, very much.
Is there anyone else in Fairbanks? All right. Hearing no one else in Fairbanks, let's see. We have that's all the names I believe I have. Is there anyone else online that did not, that wanted to testify that has not had a chance? Hearing none, we have some written comments here from, on this bill and the testimony that's been taken. This bill will remain in subcommittee here a little bit longer while we continue to work on that. And analyze some of the proposed changes. Comments from the committee?
Have we accepted the substitute?
We have adopted that, at least for discussion, so that's the bill we will be working from. Hearing no more discussion on that bill, Representative Grunberg.
Put this in the subcommittee?
It already is. Yeah. That bill is back to subcommittee, which has been working on it, and Representative Grunberg will be included in that subcommittee. The next meeting of the House State Affairs Committee will be Wednesday, March 13th. At that time will be a special meeting. Regular time, 8:30 in the morning, will be a joint meeting with the Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs, with the confirmation hearings on Hugh Cox, the Adjutant General for the Department of Veterans and Military Affairs, as well as Brigadier Generals Dan Dennis and Tom Carroll. So we'll have that right here, 8:30 in the morning. Unless there's anything else from the committee members? We're adjourned at 10:10. I'd like to talk. If you got a minute before you go.
Sure.
And you too, Betty.